The following presentation was recorded at the 2000 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
You probably heard the statement that students don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care. There's a lot of truth to that. And I'm to be talking about the lesson here and understanding the students, and I'm trying to do that. It's difficult to keep from talking about the teacher because that's really where it's at. Just last evening, I was working my way through, browsing through a little stack of magazines that I brought along up here when I came up and vowed to not take back home because I want to get these things behind me, know how these periodicals accumulate. Anyway, so I browsed through one and threw it in the waste can, and then I just thought this morning, well, now there's something there I really ought to share. And this is from a 12-year-old issue of Teacher Magazine. It's important to be able to learn what you can, where you can, from whom you can. And this is a article that talks about a lasting influence. Six young people recall the teachers who made a difference. Let me say that sometimes I overhear the question, what about the conventional or the individualized? And what about this? And that's an interesting question. That's not really the question, though. It doesn't really matter much what curriculum you have. What really matters is the teacher. If I'm wondering about a classroom and what the product of the classroom is or what comes out of the classroom, my question is not what packaged material is in that classroom, but who is the teacher? Who you are is going to have more influence on what those students do or become than the materials you have at hand. If you have a passion for teaching and compassion for students and care deeply and know some things and have something to offer, given a chalkboard and some chalk and some paper and pencil, you can do a pretty fair job of teaching some things, maybe a book of poetry or a couple of books to read to them. Now, we have a lot more than that to use. But here are several people, and I'll just read the first person commented on her teacher. She said the teacher's name was Pellman. The teacher recognized the importance of cultural identity at a time when it was rarely mentioned. This was a Puerto Rican girl living in the Bronx. And her concern for her well-being was typical of the teacher's special understanding of the students at her inner city school in Bronx. She saw you as an individual, says Manzano. She was in tune with the emotional needs of her students. If she hadn't been there, I could have become a depressed child. Another person, and of course they picked high-profile people here. One of these persons is a scriptwriter in the White House. But we learn what we can. This man says his ability to write good, clear prose under that kind of pressure did not come naturally. He learned it from one of his English teachers. He taught me how to write, says Gardner. Some people can write quickly, some can write clearly, but I learned the combination from him. I developed the ability to go into an area cold that I knew nothing about and write well because of a teacher. Another person said, I was the kid who was always asking questions. Mrs. Edding's lessons were so interesting that I always had questions about what she was talking about. That's the sign of a good teacher. Maybe not to instill curiosity, because students already have it, but to enable them to express their curiosity. That's the opening to learning. Another person, this is a person who designed the Vietnamese Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., writes about the school she went to. And a teacher there said, I really believe if you give students a sense of responsibility instead of just ordering them, you get them to try to prove themselves to you. It always left me with an incredible drive to get things done. And then some of you have heard of Ben Carson, the man who wrote Gifted Hands, the neurosurgeon who is famous for having separated several Siamese twins successfully. And he writes about, in his case, it was a fifth grade science teacher. It was really stimulating to think that there was somebody who did not think I was a dummy. Jack's science class at Higgins Elementary School in Detroit offered a rich environment for the budding scientist. The teacher emphasized the study of nature and of animals. His class visited a nearby pond to watch the ducks and the fish, and a nearby cemetery to study the trees. They attended flower shows and other events downtown. The science room had a collection of a possum, a weasel, mice, guinea pigs, birds, and a red squirrel that the children had raised. The surgeon, this is Jack, Ben Carson, remembers Jack's ease with animals, that is his teacher's ease with animals, even with a tarantula which appeared unexpectedly one day in a bunch of bananas. He was so calm with the thing, recalls Carson. It made me understand that we can interact with nature. Jack says his own love of nature and animals came through in the classroom. If the class is fun, interesting, and exciting, the teacher is interested in the subject and can communicate that excitement, the children get hooked, he says. And then there's another teacher who was a business, I think he might have been a business, he was a teacher anyway, but he operated a business at the same time. He was operating a business. He was a businessman, had a business, but his real passion was teaching. But this student who went on and eventually invented Pictionary, the game of Pictionary, said that he himself was particularly impressed by that teacher who he knew was real. That is, as he looked at it, here was a person who was actually operating a business as he taught. And when this person spoke, they knew what he was talking about, because he was actually working out there in what the students would say is the real world. Now, you hear about instances like this, and you need to, don't try to be a David and putting on Saul's armor. You may not be a person who relates to animals. Don't fill your room up with chipmunks and squirrels if you're not that kind of person. It will not work. You cannot do what somebody else does necessarily. You need to be yourself and be yourself. There's an excellent little book called The Essential Personal Qualities of Teachers. I think there might be a copy of it for sale down here in the bookstore. I don't know if you found the bookstore or not in the East Bridge there. This one there might be in that store too. The Poems Teachers Ask For, which I only discovered about 2 years ago. But in this book, there are two retired teachers who taught in the college level who talk about the qualities that you cannot learn. There are qualities that you have as a person that you just need to simply call forth and use. And there's a big part of teaching that is an art. Teaching is a little bit science, but mostly art. And he says, well, methods you can study, but art is something that you must imagine and you must practice. So there's that aspect of teaching that you do. And so some of these qualities that are absolutely essential for teachers are things like authority and order and imagination. And I don't have time to talk about these, but they say, for example, that there is no such thing as unimaginative teaching. But there are unimaginative teachers. And if we teach without imagination, our students learn without imagination, and things are dry. And then there's love and compassion, which are much the same, and patience, authenticity, and pleasure. I'll just make a few comments on the passion one. Students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And what you need to do is develop that passion for teaching. If you have a passion for something, you can hardly wait. I do remember the times in the first year or two of my teaching that the weekends seemed to get a bit long sometimes. As Sunday wore on, it was hard to wait for Monday morning to come around, because it was an opportunity to get back in the classroom. And it has not always been that way. Sometimes the weekends seem short. But to cultivate that passion, as Jesus said, how am I straitened? With desire, I have desired to share this with you. Passion, the word compassion actually means to eat the inner organs, to eat at the inner organs. And it involves suffering with the students as they struggle to replace their ignorance with knowledge, as they struggle to create order out of the chaos in their minds, to order their thoughts. There can be no successful practice of teaching, of the art of teaching, without this common experience with students. It actually causes an emotional and a physical drain on the teacher to have this kind of compassion. And you acknowledge with your students that it is difficult to reach high standards. It's going to take a while for us to develop this skill. But with compassion, you can correct them and discipline them in ways that build their respect, that build their dignity, if you will, that make them feel like more. The one poet said, I love you not for what you are, but for what I am when I am with you. And with the right kind of compassion, our students can, they somehow have a sense that when they're working with the teacher, they are more than they were before. They are growing in ways that they cannot identify. You need to act as a whole person when you enter the classroom. You need to bring your whole self in there. Don't check your heart at the door. Bring everything into the room, your whole personality. Because you need to bring that emotional life along, and that undergirds and strengthens the professional life. And the authors say that compassion is the basic measure for suitability for teaching. That is number one. You must have a compassionate heart. Absolutely, you must. If you expect to connect and care for children. And you need to be yourself. You need to be yourself. If you don't enter the room with your whole self authentically, the children will bring the rest of you there. They will do something that brings the rest of you into play. They will find out. They will do things to bring out those parts that you didn't reveal. Enough on that. All right. Let's talk about Titus, could you and the friend there, those papers, two papers, could you see that everybody gets a copy there of each one of those somehow? I want to talk this morning about some training objectives for different ages of children. This is taken from, most of these are taken from a book called Shepherding a Child's Heart. And I'll just briefly call attention to some high points here and you can look over the rest. But the first 5 years, we don't typically have children in the first 5 years. But I'll touch on this briefly because the key thing in working with a young child, as you train him, and yesterday we talked about training, the key thing is to develop obedience, to cultivate in the child a concept that he is under authority. And the major problem that you must be concerned about is defiance. And so you need to be honorable, you need to train, and the child needs to learn to obey cheerfully, immediately, and completely. And as I said yesterday, obeying only happens, true obedience shows that you can obey even if it doesn't make any sense to you. For example, the child who is not to poke the keys into the receptacle. If you wait till he's old enough to understand that, you're making a fool out of yourself. You need to keep the child from doing things like that. And so he needs to obey even if it doesn't make any sense to him. Now, we need to consider that because as children come to you, if the child comes to you in grade one or kindergarten and has not learned this, then that is really number one with you as a teacher. You need to teach this child that he can obey and he can do it cheerfully and willingly and it can be a pleasant thing to obey. All right, so let's move to the bottom of that sheet that says childhood training objectives. If you're not getting a paper, raise your hand so they can see who. Is there anybody who does not have one? All right. Ages 5 to 12 is the age that many of us teach, and first grade up through beginning through the elementary years. One of the key things here is that the child is out from under the direction of his parents. Typically, with a young child, an adult must be present all the time. We understand that. You make sure there's a babysitter or a supervisor or a Sunday school teacher or a parent or somebody around the child close all the time. But when they get a bit older, they're not under the direction of a parent or a teacher all the time, and so the child must be able to have a certain amount of self-control, and he must make some choices. Am I going to push this person out of line, or am I not? And so your one key thing to focus on in these years is to develop character in the heart of your child. Character. And so you do that by helping him develop proper concepts of, and we talked about worldview this morning. Yes, what's the view? How does this child look at things? Does the world owe me something? Do I get my own way? Proper concept of God and his responsibility. A proper concept of himself and to recognize some of his internal motives, such as wanting to be first or always wanting the best. You know, you need to train yourself that you cannot always have the best. And he needs to recognize things and patterns of his own behavior, such as if he needs to be taught and shown. Don't assume that these children recognize what talking back is. A child can talk back, a child can mock, a child can belittle, and not recognize that he's doing it. Do you know that you would never know if you're sinning if you weren't shown somehow? And that's why the Holy Spirit is so faithful to us to reveal to us when we sin. Really, sin is simply an outworking, a symptom of a problem inside. And so the Holy Spirit faithfully convicts us of sin. And so in working with a child, then we need to do that gently but firmly and truthfully and lovingly point out to him, be sure that a child learns to recognize things in his behavior that are not proper. And so he needs to, I remember the first time I recognized that I was showing off. Some person made the comment, why are you showing off? I was about probably, I don't know, 6, 8 years old in there somewhere, and you know, that really struck me. I didn't think I was showing off. And that's all that was said. The person made the comment. We had company. It was in a kind of a visiting situation. I did a lot of thinking about that. And it's not the last time I showed off, but I learned something. And somebody has to tell you. Don't assume that a child knows when he tells an untruth. At some point, he has to learn that. At some point, he has to learn that. So help him to see his patterns of behavior. Help him to accept himself. When I say that, I mean, well, some things might be harder for him. He might be shorter. Maybe other people can hit the ball and he can't hit the ball. Maybe other people can get their work done in 5 minutes and it takes him 7 minutes. Whatever. There are many conditions where he lives. And I suppose every child needs to go through this. Most children perhaps think that other people have a better lot than they do in life. Nobody has to quite work like I have to or whatever. And he needs to learn to be satisfied and accept his conditions. This is all part of character building. He needs to have proper concept of others and relationships with them. Other people are worthy of my care and attention and affection. And one of the big things you have working with you as you work in developing character in these elementary age children is their own conscience. Because when a child does something he shouldn't do, generally you can count on it that his conscience will speak to him. Whatever, however you call the conscience, but there'll be an inner voice, the spirit, however you want to call it. And so when you also say something to him and you say, Johnny, you know better than that, now we have two witnesses. And he finds himself, whether he wants to or not, he finds himself inside himself saying, yeah, she's right. Teacher's right. I shouldn't be doing that. And we have two witnesses. The conscience works. Now, the conscience, and this is alluding to a Bible verse here, the conscience meanwhile excusing or accusing. And so if the child's conscience has not been developed in that area, he has not learned, his conscience may excuse his behavior. And so if he butts in line or does something else unkind, maybe he doesn't think there's anything wrong with that. And if a person honestly doesn't see what's wrong with it, then he needs to be taught. And he needs to be shown that this is not the way you behave. This is wrong behavior. And you may not think this way. You may not do this way. And if he has the respect for you that you have cultivated as a teacher, he will learn that and he will believe it. And you help to enlarge his understanding. And you call these children to God's standard of behavior. That is, it's obvious that these are not arbitrary things that you're teaching him. You didn't decide that there are certain things we should do. But don't harp on this. Don't quote, as children say, don't preach at it. That is, don't keep driving these things. But it should be very obvious to them that when you talk about being thoughtful and kind and affectionate and patient and so on, you're not talking about things that you made up. You're talking about absolute principles that are from God. And so call him to God's standard because of who God is and who we are as children of God and who the child is, regardless of what he thinks. You see, the child has to learn. It doesn't matter. You might think that you're a nothing. You might think that you're no good. But that's not true. You are wrong. The truth is that you are something. You are something not because of what you can do, not because of who your family is. You are something because God created you and loves you. Jesus loves you, period. That's how you know. You are not worth less because of what you don't do, and neither are you worth more because of what you do do. You are what you are. And you find out we believe what we are because God reveals it to us. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. And I belong to Him. And so feelings have nothing to do with that truth. And so the child needs to be reminded, needs to learn, have a proper, the word self-concept is really maligned and really used wrongly today, but we only get a correct concept of who we are in relation to God. And it's told us, it's revealed to us. How you feel about it and what you think about it doesn't have very much to do with it. Well, it does, because that's what you will act out of, whether it's accurate or not. Now, the interesting thing at the bottom here, the statement, keepable standards turn us away from God, what that means is, you do want to call the child to the absolute standard. We are to love. We are to be kind. We are to be patient. We are to be tender-hearted. That's the standard. But it doesn't come naturally. It doesn't come naturally. I don't feel like doing that way. Well, we know. But the child at a very young age can be told that Jesus loves you And that's one of the first things a child should learn. We love you and Jesus loves you. He doesn't really know who Jesus is. He just starts to build that concept. But he knows there's someone out there who loves him, someone whom his parents know who love him. And if he gets that through and through his being early on, that will carry him through a lot of the stresses he experiences and some of these doubts that he experiences. And he knows that he's called to a high standard, something he can never do. He doesn't feel like doing, but Jesus will help you do that. And you never tell a child this age that really, you know, Johnny, the problem is that you have a deceitful heart and your heart is really set against God, and everything you imagine is going to be, as the Bible says, that the heart of man is deceitful above all things, and who can know it? And really, Johnny, there's no hope. You know, you do not tell a child that at all. That is not your responsibility. That is the Holy Spirit's responsibility to reveal to a child at the appropriate time in his life that really the reason that you're having all these problems is that there's a root problem in your heart. And at the time that the Holy Spirit reveals that, he will also reveal Christ and say, but here's Jesus. And that's why he came. And then the child is ready for what we term the new birth. But we don't wait until that time comes to call a child to proper biblical standards of all the qualities of the fruit of the Spirit, is love, joy, peace, and so on. However, we don't wait until a child has come to know the Lord in a personal way in his heart to start teaching those things. You call a child to those kinds of things as soon as you can call him to anything. And you're going to expect him to fail, but you don't tell him that, but we know children will be children. And they can, when they fail, they can be sorry for it, can find forgiveness, they can be innocent and happy and joyful and go on. Even though they may do wrong again, they can again be joyful and they can go on. So the problem with not expecting a child, if you expect them to, if you set the standard low enough and the child reaches a standard, that is, if you don't really see, expect them to do some scrapping and squabbling and fighting, you don't really care, why then the child may feel that he can do it. You know, he can be good enough. He doesn't really need Jesus. Has some long-term goals of seeing good behavior. Let's turn to the backside of the sheet. And once a child reaches puberty and goes through his adolescent years, which can last longer or shorter. Some of you might wonder whether you're still out of adolescence. Well, it's a wonderful time. It's a wonderful time. Because adolescence involves this person actually coming into his own, so to speak, becoming his own person. And for those of you working with children in grades, in junior high and high school, it's a time of great insecurity. Because the child who might have been very secure before, having a good home life, a good classroom setting, all of a sudden, he has to start standing on his own feet. And he has to start thinking, you know, am I thinking this because I think it, or am I just thinking this because other people told me what to think? That's just one of the kinds of things that he goes through. And he has to come into his own standing, in a sense, before God, and this can happen wonderfully as the person moves and has the support of the teachers and parents, and comes into his own, and yet he has to stand on his own feet, so to speak, or it's better to say, find his own personal relationship with God. And so it's a time of insecurity. It's a time of worry. It's a time of anxiety. Am I going to have what it takes to meet the future? Am I going to, in 6 years, be living on my own? I certainly can't now. And even though I might want to, and I can't imagine. See, these children looking ahead, they can't imagine what it would be like or imagine. And you can't really go into something if you can't imagine what it would be like. And so they're really not sure what is happening. They have great ideas, wonderful ideas. They can reason, rationalize, talk, but they don't have the experience to match it. And so, they're changing, but they resist being changed. That is, they want to grow up, and yet they don't want to. They want to, and yet they don't want to. And there's an excellent little story about, that I'll just refer to here, about Frog, I believe it was, who had a house with an upstairs and a downstairs. And he liked both. Sometimes he went upstairs and he just loved it. And then he went downstairs and he loved it. And then he got perplexed because he thought, really, what would be wonderful is if I could be both places at the same time. And so he ran upstairs and said, now I'm upstairs, but I'm not down. And so he went up and down the steps as fast as he could. But he never was able to achieve being both places at once. And so he finally came to the conclusion that he will sit in the middle of the stairway, which he did. And he sat there and he had a think, with a capital T. And then he realized, now I'm neither place. And so he was perplexed. And that is really the condition that you have when you work with children in grades 7 and 8 and 9. They walk into your room and some days they're upstairs. That is, they're very adult-like in the way they talk and think. And the next day, they walk in, and they are downstairs. And they're very childish in the way they talk and think and act. Furthermore, they switch during the day. They switch during the day. And in fact, they switch during the class period. And they don't all switch at the same time. Some are going up, some are coming down, some are in the middle of the stairs, some are up, some are down. And you're working with this group. Isn't it wonderful to have compassion? Isn't it wonderful to be able to feel with them? To say, that's okay. That's okay. Don't make light of it. Don't make light of it. Because it's hard. It's hard. But yes, they want to grow up and they know they're growing up, but it's fun to be a child. But no, I don't want to stay a child. And so this is how they're changing very fast. And in a sense, some rebel, some don't rebel, some just trial new rules, and they, in a sense, they have to do something like this in order to see who they are, in order to establish their, to kind of trial their own way of thinking and their own talents. Well, what do we do? The writer suggested here three big objectives are, he said it's a good time to have them read the minor prophets, or read them to them. It's a good time for them to develop a healthy fear of God, a sense of when you're young, you learn much about God, and you should teach young children that Jesus loves you. When you start coming into your own, you want to also make sure they don't forget, they understand that God is a God of justice, and God is a God of order, and He calls us to account. And so develop a healthy fear of the Lord. They need to learn the part of reverence that has to do with trembling. You don't come casually sauntering into the house of God, say, hi there, God, how are you all today? That's not the way you approach God. You approach God with carefully, with the trembling in your heart. Teens need to learn this, that our God is a big God and He is powerful. They need to see the reaction of Isaiah, who came and he said, woe is me, for I am undone. Teens are ready for this kind of understanding. And the more the fear of God you have, the less the fear of man you have. And so if you're concerned with peer pressure, hey, you don't have enough of the fear of God. You have not seen enough of God. Get them to see the Lord. And then this is a time for instruction. Be honest with them. Address the issues that they are thinking about. Don't talk around the issues. Talk about what they're thinking about as appropriate. And they need to learn to associate with the good. You become very much like those whom you are with. And some of the procedures, well, the Holy Spirit is working hard in the lives of these people. And you, with the wisdom you have, work with Him to help Him to internalize the gospel. He's heard the Bible stories. He knows the teaching. He's heard all these things. And now, how do these acts to become part of me? How do I internalize these things? Point him to the right Don't try to get in that heart and manipulate it and make him do it, but call him to it. Call him to it. Don't nitpick on the little things, but point in the right direction. These people will have some very real and very personal doubts and questions, and they are real. You may not have any, you may have never had a problem with that question, or you may have never had a doubt like that. But that doesn't mean that this particular individual doesn't. And he needs to know that it's okay to ask God, do you really love me? How do I know that? And they need to wrestle through some of these things, and it's a painful time, but you can't hurry it up. You can't take the butterfly out of his chrysalis and say, here, you don't have to struggle out. You can just fly. There are things that need to be struggled through in these years, and you need to care. And the thing is that all the time, see, when these people are struggling with these questions, you're trying to teach them the difference between an adverbial clause and an adjective clause. Do they care? Well, yes, the thing is that many of these things that they learn, and we have a job to do as teachers, and we do not turn and focus on the problem and say, oh, here, you have a doubt today, don't you? No, that's not how you do it. It's along the way, as you're working with them, going by the way, he needs to understand that you care about him and that you're aware of his doubt, especially with men, I suppose it's true with women too, but with men all and fellas, oftentimes you get further by having almost your focus on something else. You're working on something together, and as you're working on this thing together, why these other real things that are kind of bothering you, they have a way of maybe being dealt with or touched on without really turning your attention on them and talking about them head on, at least in the classroom. Help him find strength in knowing God. This is the time for a teacher to testify of how you find strength in God, to give testimony, stories in your devotions of some of the things that you wrestled through. And testimonies are so powerful. And help them think Christianly. This is worldviews you just heard. To think Christianly about this. What would I do with my money? And in whatever class you have, if you're talking in consumer math, you're talking about investing money or using money or buying or saving money and so on, making deals, getting bargains, you know, what's the Christian view on this? How do we do, regardless of what we think, what does the Bible have to say about this? All right, at the bottom, I won't go over all that. You can read through that, but I'll just call attention to this distinction between training, chastisement, and punishment. As many of these thoughts are taken from the book called What the Bible Has to Say About Child Training. And training, I already alluded to, it's causing a person to perform, to do the right thing, whether it's learning how to perform to form proper letters, or whether it's behavior. And then chastisement involves some kind of suffering, which generally with children it's corporal chastisement, but some kind of suffering that really is a warning. And it's a sense of deliverance of what would be much worse to come. It's a kind of rescue, because if you do not chastise and the person keeps going down that road, eventually he's going to fall off the cliff. Eventually he will be destroyed. And so you chastise for things such as rebellion, because rebellion is a sin of witchcraft. And in a child, rebellion must not be allowed to grow. It must be dealt with. And also foolishness, the foolishness that does ridiculous things without thinking, without giving a thought to the consequences of it. Children must learn to think before they act. You don't just throw something first and then afterward consider where it might land. You need to think before you act. And so those are two distinctive things, foolishness and rebellion. That call for chastisement also, if you hurt someone willfully, willful behavior like that when the child doesn't care. Now, punishment is something different. Punishment is a payment, a final payment. It's closely related to restitution. And so if you, and it's very objective, it can be very unpassionate, you might say. And so if you do a slovenly job on the paper that you hand in, well, you do it over. And in many cases, a child knows exactly what's coming. And the fascinating thing is, that I should call your attention to, is when a child disobeys, is he punished or chastised? Well, if he willfully disobeys, that if you say, all right, now it's time to sit down, and the child says by his actions, so I don't care what you say, I'll stand up if I want to stand up. Or if he says, I'll do it when I'm good and ready, that calls for, it's a matter of the will, calls for chastisement. Now, if a child, you tell your children at the beginning of the year, boys and girls, I want you on your papers to put your name at the top of each paper before you pass it in, and also put the date and the subject. All right, so they do this. This is done very well. And about 3 weeks into the school year, Jason passes in the paper without his name. And I say, now, Jason, did you understand that you were to put your name on every paper you pass in? Yes, I did. And you disobeyed me. Yes, I did. All right. Does that call for chastisement? Well, when a person, it may call for punishment. You may, if a person can't remember to put his name on his paper, you might have him do, he needs to be, it calls for training. That's what it calls for. It calls for something to happen to him. If I want the names in the paper, I have to do something to make sure the names get in the paper. No, so you can call almost anything disobedience that you don't like. You can call it disobedience. You can say, oh, it's too noisy here in the room. Now I told you to be quiet. Now you're disobeying me. Well, who was making, okay, I think you get the point. So, with many of the things that you want them to stand in line and all the routines you want them to do, and somebody forgets to push his chair and before he goes up to the chalkboard, and, oh, you disobeyed me. Well, that kind of, if you chastise the child or something like that, you're violating the child, you're violating principles. You need to train the person to do that. Maybe he needs to walk. If he runs, he needs to go back and walk again. You need to do something. Maybe he needs to copy his name 100 times on a piece of paper. I had a student who just inveterately could not remember, or for whatever reason would not put periods at the end of his sentences. And I just, it wasn't a difficult thing to do. I gave him, handed the paper back, flipped it over and said, I want to see 10,000 dots in the back of this paper. It might have been 1,000. I probably started with 1,000. And so, that wasn't too hard. He sat back there. And he didn't do it noisily. And he made 1,000 dots. And so I said, okay, fine, now let's see if you remember to put periods. And it took a couple times like that, but he eventually started putting periods on the ends of his sentences. So you have to come up with something to train the person to remember to do what we are to do here. And if the person, he's congenial about it, he doesn't really oppose putting periods at the end of the sentence, but for some reason he just, all right. Let's move to the other sheet that was passed out, and that is characteristics of the 12 to 14-year-old. Now, this is related to the training objectives closely. However, the training objectives deal with how you work with a child as a person, whereas these other areas, I want to give a few comments on what it has to do with how you go about teaching or establishing routines in the classroom. So we're talking here about grades 7, 8, 9, 12 to 14-year-olds in general. He's growing rapidly, externally and internally. He's not too sure about the internal growth. Sometimes you aren't either, but it is happening. Make sure they have opportunity for activity, for muscular coordination activities. These are people who The last 2 years, the boys could hit a ball out over in the center field every time, and now they can't even hit the ball. They're striking out because their arms grew that much. They don't know where the end of the bat is. And sometimes these people grow that fast that they aren't sure where their feet are, and so they're tripping over things, kicking things, because they're literally they're growing that fast that they're having trouble adjusting to where the end of their limbs are. And their voices are changing, and they're not quite sure when it's going to squeak or whether it will quiver or what. And so it's a great time of fast growth, and they feel awkward, and love them, accept them. It's okay. It's a good sign. It's a good sign. That's exciting. It's a sign that you're growing up. And don't feel, if it wouldn't be happening, if the child's is getting awkward, and you say, wow, that should be exciting to you because it's a sign that you're growing. And so who else is there? Maybe, well, I wouldn't care that to the extreme, but you might want everybody to want to feel awkward, so he's growing up. So anyway, the point is don't make them feel that this is bad for this to be happening. He likes to eat. You do want to encourage good eating, and if you're going to have a snack or party or whatever, or bring snack in, you can avoid always just having the junk food. Teach them the value of carrot sticks and other such goodies. And another one, he asks, the boys may feel inferior because the girls are ahead of them. And sometimes, you need to have some separate activities. You'll find that girls' lung capacity, if you ever do this little check of what your lung capacity is by water displacement in science class, you'll find that it's not the wisest thing to do with grades 7 and 8 because the girls have quite a bit more lung capacity than the boys, and the boys don't think that ought to be that way because they're bigger and stronger. Well, the girls are simply ahead in their growth. Actually, his heart can be overstrained. That is, he fatigues easily. Don't have them do strenuous activities. Don't expect those boys at age 13 and 14 to break any mile records. It's okay to run. It's okay to get tired, but don't push them to try to set any records. Be patient with them and recognize, yes, they really alternate between energy and fatigue. One time they don't have enough energy to stand up and walk to the chalkboard. Next time they have too much to sit down. And you need to kind of go with that. There's a time to go out there and get strenuous activity, and there's a time to let them relax and read to them. They do like power, well, especially the fellas. They like power or anything that has to do with power. And well, it's okay to grow up, but you don't want to show off. Now, they can memorize, but they like a reason for memorizing. And so if you can somehow, if they memorize, use it somehow, have them recite, have them see more the value or the meaning. Think a little, talk about the truths. If you memorize a poem like Nobility, talk about the truths in there so that he sees there really is something here. He still likes adventure and discovery. Help him to discover things in the Bible, Bible truths. Help him to have that sense of discovery that when we, as we study in our books, we are discovering things that we didn't know before. And you see, you can actually be doing something and not realize what you're doing, but to be reminded that here we're learning this for the first time. For you, it's brand new. You never knew before that the same force that brings an apple to the ground also keeps the moon in orbit around the earth. So for you, it's a new discovery. Help them to have that sense. When it comes to reading and taking things in, his interests are indiscriminate. He or she will read anything they can get their hands on. And so help them to discriminate, to know what is good and what is not good and why. And primarily emphasize the good. Read them little passages from books that are good, that are worthwhile. Develop a healthy appetite for the good. Don't push too hard on talking about the junk, because that can tend to make them check it out to see whether it's true or not, what you told them. He is capable of real thinking. Give him some problems
to Saab. Direct him to some resources. Challenge him to do a bit of research. And with his knowledge being ahead of his experience, well, that's okay. You can't have the experience to keep up with your knowledge. But just keep him aware of the fact that, yes, it's okay to think. It's okay to have these ideas. And you need to have some. In fact, you ought to have some vision, some ideas ahead of where you are so that you have something to move forward into. But let him realize that his parents also, they do think. They have reasons for what they do, and they have experience to go with it. And so they should always respect the older people, even though it might seem the older people are not acting out of their knowledge sometimes. In making snap judgments, challenge him to use God's standards. He tends to judge by his own standards very quickly. That's neat. That's right. Yeah, that's the way to do it. Well, now, wait a minute. On what basis do you say that? There's such a thing as God's standard. He will judge the group by the behavior of one member. And so all mechanics are like that. All big people are like that. All Mennonites are like that. All Amish are like that. He will tend to make a snap judgment and challenge these people to, wait a minute, I point out to my students, somebody drives past the school here, they don't know anything about this school except what they see happening on the playground. And if they saw you do something that's not kind, I know about that school. That's what that school is. Mm-hmm. They push people there. Would you want them to judge the school by what they see you do? Well, no, they don't think that. Well, okay, you don't judge other people by what you see in one person either. You need to think. They have little sympathy for people that make mistakes. Challenge them to broaden their thinking. He does want to think for himself. Allow some opportunities to do that. He has a strong sense of humor. It's okay to laugh sometimes, but you have to control that. He also likes to argue, loves to argue. Good time for having some reasonable debates. And this is the time for them to start learning that there is more than one way of looking at many things. And furthermore, there's more than one right way of looking at many things, at some things. And furthermore, the other person's way of looking at it might be better than yours. And I'm talking about a variety of things like how you grow soybeans in rows, or do you sow them with a drill? Well, my dad puts them in rows. He row crops. So that's the way to do it. Oh, I see. I wonder why the neighbor doesn't do that. Well, why doesn't he? Well, there's thousands of things like that that you could talk about. He needs to recognize that not everybody does everything in the same way, and there isn't just a way to do things, and furthermore, it's my way, and my way is the right way, and so everybody else. You need to start at this age to have them be able to think that there are other ways of looking at this. Not everybody raises chickens in the same way. Some people think their way is... All right, moving on to the social. He wants to be grown up. Don't teach him, don't treat him like a child. Treat him as, be honest, respectful as he is. Don't come out and say, if you act like a child, I'll treat you like a child. No, don't. Don't tell these people that he's that. Just treat them. And you need to, these people almost have to relearn respect for children. If you work with this age, you know what I mean. They can be very obnoxious when it comes to relating, especially as a group, when it comes to relating to first and second graders. Maybe it's a form of wanting to be as grown up as they can and distance themselves from that. But they can be vexed by the behavior of these younger children. And I remember telling one of my sons when he saw a 2 or 3-year-old acting a certain way, I said, everybody's entitled to be 2 one time for a year. You're entitled to be 2 years old for a year. You had your turn, and your younger brother will have his turn. And then everybody's entitled to be 14 for a year, too. And that's okay. So respect them for where they are. All right. They should not talk about little kids and think about they should respect them. Maybe you have to have them do some things. Send them down to practice oral reading for story time with the first graders. Play some games together sometimes with the whole school together. Get that interaction so you can keep it. Yes, he's often tactless. He just does, says what he thinks. Well, it's nice to be straightforward and honest, but you also need to learn to be aware of other people's feelings, and you need to learn that there's such a thing as politeness and courtesy and manners. That is biblical. Believe it or not, it is biblical to be courteous and to be polite and to think before you speak. He wants to be independent, so there are times that you can give him some responsibility and a few choices. You don't have to bend over backwards to do that, but you can give some alternative assignments or just a little choice here and there, and recognize that it's time for you to start learning some responsibility. But then if you decide to do it that way, well, you follow through. He has a great sense of loyalty, and you need to recognize that. You need to recognize his loyalty. Don't fight it. Don't fight it, or he will work. You'll just strengthen it. That is, if he's sticking with a group, a clique that is not healthy, and you just simply try to extinguish that, it won't work. You need to simply approach the bigger picture of loving everyone, respecting everyone, loving God, fearing God, and get his attention on the bigger picture. Tell him about missionaries, about the suffering Christians in other parts of the world, about other things. And when you get your mind on some of these bigger things, well, then these little things right around you don't become as significant to you. Help him see in his self-consciousness that he's not the only person with problems. Everybody does have problems, and it's just a matter of what they are. Now, that doesn't mean that you minimize it. Yes, they are self-conscious, but this child needs to recognize that he's not the first person who ever lived. He's not the first person who ever had problems. We really are much more alike than we are different. He still is a hero worshiper, much like the younger child is, and again, hold up good models of behavior, Bible characters, a good time to talk about. I think one place we go wrong is doing too much trying to teach doctrine and belief systems and all that to these children. You still really ought to focus on people. Let him learn about people. Let him learn about the life of Joshua and the life of Caleb and the life of Abraham and the life of Joseph and the life of Isaiah. Think about people, because he's becoming a person. And you have to become a person first before you start working through these finer points of the law and of systematic belief. And it's possible to learn all the right answers and say all the right things and still not have your personhood developed. So hold up worthy people. And then recent people, other saints and people in history that did well. And also people who lived. Just last year, we tried something in our old school devotions at our school. We had, I asked the people who came in to share to try to think of someone whom they could remember, but who had already died, that the children, most of them, did not remember, and to talk about that person's life in such a way. Talk about some ways that person's life exemplified Bible principles, Bible characters. And a little in the sense that, you see, the Bible says the Scripture is given for all these people lived, for our examples in the Scripture. And the saints didn't stop in Bible times. There are many saints and good people since then. And to also talk about some other people. In some cases, it was grandparents or great-grandparents of the children, people who lived and walked in the same community, and to talk about these people's love for their neighbors or their interest in whatever. And that was an attempt to have them think about how Christianity and how life lived out today is so valuable and you can see Christianity lived out. Emotionally, he feels misunderstood. Try to understand and show genuine caring. And his emotions, as I said, fluctuate hourly. Don't hold him to an adult standard. Actually, these people are grown up in size, but they're really, spiritually, they're babies. And you don't expect of a baby what you do of an adult. Now, I think you understand what I mean. They're not, they're really just coming to a personal faith. And so you need to appreciate them, understand them, and don't expect them to be an adult in their emotions. Present Christianity in a very positive way. That it is a wonder. It is a good thing. It's not something that's a list of musts and mustn'ts. Yes, there are some musts in the Bible, but it's more a privilege. It's a call. It's an opportunity. It's a life. It's a way of living, and there's no end to. In Christ are all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, and the kingdom of God is love and joy and peace and the Holy Ghost. It's a wonderful life. They should start getting the view that there's a big life here to live with the Lord. There's something to grow into, not something when you come into the Christian life, you don't narrow yourself down to try to fit it in some little box. But no, it's quite the opposite. You only then come to yourself and really live with God. He needs to develop a vision like this, even if he has not come to know God personally. He should know that Christians see it as a very full life. He does at this time, he cannot control his emotions. They may burst out in laughter, they may get disgusted, or whatever, and so you need to have supervision, that is, you need to be able to look ahead and recognize what will spark that. And so you don't push the buttons. You avoid doing things that will trigger these uncontrolled emotions. And so give some thought to how you establish your routines and what you do so that you don't trigger these emotions he cannot control. His emotions are very intense. This is a time, well, you want to be calm yourself. And this is a time now that in his religion and as he thinks about Christ, that he's going to bring his emotions into play. Younger children are very, very practical when they think about God and Jesus. But these people start to really feel emotionally, and you want to encourage them to direct their affections, their feelings toward the right and toward Christ and God. And yet, spiritually, he wants a practical religion in the sense that how's this thing work? And so he's not so interested in doctrine and philosophy, but he may very well think that doing right is what Christianity is. Well, that's part of it, but it is much more than that. Show him that believing has a way too, and this is. Both believing and doing. And this is how, again, the stories of men like Joshua and Abraham, these great patriarchs who walked and talked with God, can take on new meaning to them. And so they know the story. You don't need to necessarily read through the whole story, but you can start referring to these men. All right. He wants to serve. Give him some opportunity. Give him some responsibility. Maybe you want to take them singing in a rest home, have them write letters to old folks, or think of ways to give them opportunity to serve. And yes, he is upset by hypocrisy because he doesn't like, you know, if this is supposed to be the way Christianity is, why then what about these people over here? Well, he needs to learn not to be so judgmental and to just write people off, because we do, in fact, fall short of doing. But we do want to, in our hearts, love and serve God. Help them see that men like Jacob, even though he did some things that were really out of line, he just had a heart for God. And he had a heart for God so much that, and David did the same thing, a man after God's own heart, so much that he made some very grievous mistakes in trying to serve God. And so, yes, people do sin, but God, loving God is what is important. And he wants an ideal. He wants the ideal. That's the time to really point him to Christ. Christ is the ideal. And also, the consistency in your life as a teacher is absolutely vital at this time for you to be consistent. All right. I think I'll stop there on that. And today we want to start the other thing a bit earlier. I talked in planning the lesson the other day about having objectives and having a... Could you pass these out? See, everybody gets one. One of the things that you can do when you teach is you have certain things you want people to learn, but one of the other things you can do is sometimes you want them to have an experience. And when you have an experience, sometimes as a teacher, you aren't quite sure how all this is going to work out, but you kind of have something in mind. And I thought it would be appropriate for us to have an experience today together. And I have some vision of what this could be like, but we won't know until this is over what the experience will be like. And so we're going to have a little field trip, and we will, when we dismiss here, we're going to combine our break with our field trip. That is, you can get yourself a drink, whatever you need, but then we'll meet in the field. I like to meet there at probably 25 after. We're going to pay a visit to a cemetery. And the cemetery is within walking distance of here, so I didn't have to arrange for transportation. You brought your transportation with you. But I've done this actually in teaching. It's been a number of years ago. I've done it just once with a group of junior high students. And there was a cemetery. Many of our schools are located close to churches, and often every community has a cemetery. And let's just think a bit about this. Visiting a cemetery, depending how you do that, it could be a rather morbid experience. It could be you might wonder, you know, what is this? What's going on? But I tried to look at this from a variety of perspectives. And as you think of being a history teacher, a creative writing teacher, a Bible teacher, a science teacher, a math teacher, and so on, here are some kinds of things. We're going to walk to Union Cemetery, which is a rather interesting one in a number of ways. And I want you to take this paper along. It would be helpful if you had probably a notebook or something to lay the paper on. Take a pencil along, and I want you to discover some things, to find some things. Let me go over this a bit with you. I put a few things on here. One of the things to get your minds going, one of the things that you can ask yourself when you walk into a cemetery is, what's the story behind? This is really a question to ask in any subject. If you're going to study a section on Edwin Drake, who, by the way, is the man who ran around the world to try to get away from the Spanish. And he was successful, by the way. And you have, whatever the lesson is, you ask yourself, what's the story here? What do we care about? Now, as you walk into the cemetery, what is it to look at? Well, yes, what is it to look at? There are tombstones. And there are flowers and plants and so on. Now, a couple of things that could come to your mind is what might be, see, we don't know. And this is particularly interesting because we're not from this community. I'm not either. But what might be the story behind Ward Applegate's death in 1963 at age 19? Now, you can get a little bit of a clue of that if you find the tombstone in the cemetery. Or the Miller brothers, one who died at 3 months of age in 76, and And then 2 months in 77, I think maybe there was, well, I won't say any more than that. And then the Bahim children. What do you suppose might have happened on March 11th, 1883? Now, in aesthetics and beauty, there are a variety of ways you can look at this place. And one of the glasses you can put on is the aesthetic glasses, that is the beauty. And just look at things like decorations, unusual stones, flowers, perennials, annuals. What are there any unusual pictures? What might be behind that? And why might the people have had those pictures engraved on the stones? Now, history, if you went into this, and for those of you who live here, Michael, there's an excellent opportunity for some local research. There are names that I've been here just a couple summers, but I recognize names there that are names of some of these roads around here. And so there are things that could actually be followed up. Now, one of the things I want you to think about as you go here, there's actually a couple things will happen here. You will have an experience. We will have an experience. What all this experience is going to be like, I don't know. Some of you may be bored. Somebody might be cold. Somebody might be enamored. Somebody might end up writing a creative writing piece. I don't know what experience you will have. But I have some ideas. I want you to think as you do this. I want you to have your wheels turning, your creative ideas going, and think of kinds of things that you could do, what ideas that you get of things that you could do. You could assign, if you were living here, you could assign somebody to try to find somebody in the community who could answer some questions about some things that are raised there. Well, what about the flags? Why are if you're a history teacher, why are those flags there? Why are they where they are? And when you study history, you study a variety of wars. How many wars are represented here? And do you think these people actually died in the war, or did they just die and there's attention called to the fact that they served? Or maybe they weren't in the war, maybe they just served in the army. What nationalities can you recognize in the names in these stones? Are there any Polish people here? What about the community here? Are they French? What are they? Thinking as a history teacher. And then going to creative writing. Excellent, excellent opportunity for creative writing. And I don't just mean morbid creative writing either. Many other kinds of creative writing. And that is, there's a couple things that you could you could sit down and write. In fact, I suggest we'll take about an hour down there. I'd suggest that some of you might want to try that. If you have a bent for that, sit down, flip your paper over, and see if you can write a little poem. Or something. There's some things that could stimulate that. One is the overall character of the cemetery as a whole. What about this whole, the whole place? Every cemetery has its character. It's the way it's kept. You could think about the possibility, if you did an experience like this with your students, of if they did some creative writing, they might actually then have opportunity to read it on site to the group. Or they could write on site. You have art class outside. You could sit there and write. If you're thinking about Bible, teaching Bible, think about stories of faith. Think about what would be a good Bible passage to sit down in a circle on the ground in the cemetery, take a Bible along and read to them in this context of a cemetery. What stories would you read? What would be some appropriate scriptures to read on site? What faiths are represented? Is there any sign anywhere that there was a Jew or that there was a person of a... Or is there any way of knowing that these people had faith in Christ? Does it show up? How? How does it show up? And then in science, there are flowers, bushes, trees... and then some specific things like types of stones. Why do you think you can read some and you can't others? And if you're going to have a stone, what kind of stone would you have? Because if you want it to last. And must there be foundations? And what about the foundations? So why must there be one? It might not seem appropriate, but you can find humor anywhere. And humor is when something seems to be ironic. Something seems to be kind of out of place. All right? And in music, think of songs of faith. Think of what it might mean to take some songs along to sing something like Beyond the Sunset, or what songs would be appropriate. And then with literature, think of kinds of things that you might read that would really be underlined or added to after a visit. Following, when you do a visit like this, you could do something with it for the next month. You could do something for a couple days before you go, like I'm doing here for a couple of minutes, and then you could go there and you can go once or twice, and then you could touch on those things in various ways throughout the year in science history and so on. And then, of course, you could do some mundane math. You could find out when do you suppose the cemetery started? When is the what year might it have started? How would you tell that? And how long do people live? And what's the size of the stones? If you really wanted to do some hands-on things, you could figure out the density, what the capacity of this is. How you would know when it's full based on the square feet of the space. That, in fact, is a very real question if you would be working on a cemetery board. And another very fascinating thing to look for in cemeteries is epitaphs. There are some in the cemetery. And if there's anything that's profound, it's to stand at a stone when all you see is a name and dates, and then all you know about the person or his family, you don't know which put it there, is that one line that you read, and to think about why they put that on there and what it says about them. And then there are many other kinds of things. Are there any unusual names? Any signs of unusual deaths or catastrophes? Or you could design a scavenger hunt in the sense that you would have a list of, and not a humorous thing, but a list of 20 questions, and that you would have to progress through and figure some things out as you work through here. You could speculate, try to figure out relationships here. Is there, are these brothers or these sisters? What's the story here? You do want to talk about etiquette, that is behavior. If you take a group to a place like this, you do not run around in a cemetery. You don't play games there. You don't jump around. You don't do horseplay or shout or scream. And think as you go, if you did something like this with a group, how would you adapt this to first graders? Or is it appropriate? Would you do it with high schoolers? What would you do it? How about if you do it with a youth group? And another miscellaneous thing, do you see an idea there? You say, I never thought of that. That would be a good idea for a... So now, and this is one kind of thing. This happens to be close to us. You may have something in your area. There may be a park. There may be a business place. There may be a feedlot, a farm, whatever that you could go to. But so what I want you to do is, and by the way, let me just point out a couple things to get some mechanics out of the way here. The best way to get there for a group like this would be to go out the same stairs that you use when you go down for lunch. Go out that doorway, which would be the front of the building, and walk along the road. Not on the road, but it's possible to go down the steps and stay on the grass the whole way down towards the township building. You can stay on the grass, or there's even a bark path right down to where you see the big gravel piles of the township building. Just go past those gravel piles on the left. Now, if you beat children, I'd tell you don't go over the gravel piles. Stay off the gravel piles. But anyway, go past those gravel piles, and as you get past the township building, you will get to a... what used to be a gravel road, but now it's chip and oil, a little road. And there you turn right, and then you walk a couple hundred yards, and you'll come to the cemetery on your left. All right, out the door, Not along the grass, along the road, till you get to the road turning right, walk over there, and you'll be in the cemetery. Now, the cemetery is basically a square. Most of the things that I refer to on here, you would find in more or less an L shape. That is, the road that you approach the cemetery along, the whole band of stones along that road, along the Chip and Oil Road, in about maybe 100 feet, and then also an L shape as you arrive at the cemetery on the side towards the wildlife refuge. And so you would find and because of the time factor, we won't have time to walk over everything, but let me just make sure that you get that straight. I won't ask who's directionally challenged here. We know we have all kinds of people. But as you approach the road, you'll be coming down this, we're here, we'll go down along the road here and down this road. Cemetery sits right here on the intersection. And most of the things that I refer to, you'll find in this kind of an area. I don't care where you walk, but you can go in this area too, but you'll be able to get answers and ideas for most of the things in this kind of a band in the cemetery. So our purpose is to try to find answers to a few of these questions. Our purpose is to get ideas of kinds of things that you could do with a group of students that would stimulate their thinking and help them learn and relate school stuff, we'll call it, to a real life experience here in terms of historical events, stimulation of creative writing, bringing out the meaning of some Bible passages, putting a new life into a song, and so on. And then also, another purpose would be for you to think of a kind of experience that you might take a group back home, that you might take them to. Think of other kinds of places you might take them besides a cemetery. You need to consider the group that you take, and it can be a very, you can approach, you don't have to approach the cemetery with, it does not need to be a morbid feel. I mean, this is real. This is life. And you can approach it. In fact, you could approach it. If you were taking a group of students, you wouldn't try to do all these things at one time that I'm showing you here. You would select something, probably. If you're a history teacher, you might take them there for a purpose, a specific purpose. We're going to look for people that lived in this time period, or we're going to look for any signs of some historic events here that showed up on this tombstone. For example, do you know that there was a flu in 1918 that, if you would check back in your family, I can almost guarantee you that every one of your families somewhere in your family tree lost a member in 1918 or 1919 in the flu. That is, you ask, if you don't know, you ask your parents or grandparents and say, do you know anybody who died in 1918 or 19 from the worldwide flu? It was right at the end of World War I. How many of you know that somebody in your family died from that flu? You check it and you'll find that's the case. In my case, it was my grandmother and my one great uncle, both. A historical event like that, you could go and here you could find, oh yes, here's a stone that says 1918. No, you don't know, but possibly. All right, let's go for break, and we'll plan to meet down there at about 25 of. We'll head down that way, and we'll spend probably the best part of an hour there. Maybe I'll find a whistle and I'll try to give the word when we want to be back here and up here by at least 20 of 12, so we have a few minutes yet at the end to kind of pull some things together. Any questions? All right, thank you. You're dismissed. you down there with behavioral objectives, expecting that when you come back, you will now think this or feel that or do this or do that. But somebody say something about your experience. What did you see, feel, think about, wonder about? Like to play golf, you say. How do you know?
I had a golfer on his tombstone.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yes, did anybody copy any epitaphs down? Let's hear a couple. Wendell?
At rest.
At rest. All right. Another one. Yes, back there.
Live so that no matter what happens, it couldn't happen to a nicer person.
Another one. Okay. Would you stand up and read that again? I'm not sure they could all hear you because of the thing. That's a good one.
I am in my Father's house, no longer on the stormy sea. I am made perfect in holiness, for everlasting glory is here for me.
Thank you. Another one. Yes.
Until the day break,
until the day break and the shadows flee. Who recognizes that from a song? Mm-hmm. And if you pick up passages like that, it's an illusion. And when the person looks at it, it brings back the whole song, the whole thought to you. Another one. Okay. Another. Yes.
A good scout.
All right. Rachel? In our hearts forever. Yes. All right. And the Bahaim children at the pillar there gives you some pause for thought, doesn't it? What might have happened? And you don't need to push that. You don't need to do that. But if you want some, what ideas would you have for creative writing or compositions or poetry to stimulate writing? Let's hear some. What might a person who sees some of these things, what might you write about, or what assignment could you give?
Why are flowers used at tombstones?
Yes. Why flowers are used at tombstones? That's a good one. Why do they have flowers there? We don't have time to pursue these. It would be fascinating to discuss it. What else? Another fascinating would be to, if you're familiar with the Spoon River Anthology by Edgar Lee Masters, he writes about people in Spoon River. Spoon River is, who knows where Spoon River is? It's in Illinois, close to the Iowa border. It actually is a real place. And he wrote about, some of them are sonnets, but he writes about the people. And you could write a short poem about the person's life. I mean, the interesting thing about being in a cemetery where you don't know anybody is that you can get the big picture of humanity. Have we not all one Father? There's not one God made us all. And you realize that we walk this same earth, we have the same experiences, and you can, in a sense, get enough distance, enough perspective to think about some of the bigger things because you don't really know the people involved. But there are, you can use your imagination and think about kinds of things that, about people's lives. And you can consider the kinds of illustrations they put on the tombstones and talking about worldview and purpose in life, depending on the age of your students. And then with history, see, you could go there with particular purposes, with particular focuses. And so you could go there specifically to look for example, names, and to try to figure out what names are represented here. And so we have names like Kusanovic and Kuncilla and Plaski that sound like, what are they, Slavic, Eastern European? And then
This, in fact, was an area that the French controlled. You know about the French and Indian War. Well, the French came down the lakes, and from Erie they came right down through this area down to what's today Pittsburgh and had Fort Duquesne down there. You would really expect to find some French names around this area. And there's some over there. There's a Beauchat, Beauchat, probably the French would say. And there's a road around here by that name, B-E-U-C-H-A-T. And we saw people who were involved in what wars? Let's hear them. Civil? War of 1812. Korean.
World War II.
Two. Vietnam. World War I. Did anybody see any? All right. And so, and there are mathematical things. And so, and you have this, one of you was pointing out there at the Byham obelisk, how that the two children who died on the same day, we don't know what happened, but the other child was born, apparently, about a year after they died, almost to the month, maybe the day, and then died just a bit later. We don't know. Now, if you thought that was appropriate and you were in the locality, you could try to do a little local, you talk about real history now, you could have a child who's interested. One of these children who is a gifted child and likes the interpersonal relationship and challenge them to find out. Probably somebody in this community knows the story. There is a story there, and somebody probably knows. How would you go about finding out? Well, that's where the giftedness comes in, the imagination of somebody to do that. And yes, the overall view, and that's something we did not do, just to sit. And of course, if you visited that alone, it would have a different character than visiting it with a group too. But if you just sat down there and considered the overall view of the cemetery, you could write a poem. In fact, if you want your children to write, you send them out for art class sometimes, take them out to write also. Take them up on a hillside where they can see over the hill. Take them write. Put them in different settings. You don't have to go so far to get in a different setting. And try writing. The setting affects the way you write. And think of the power of calling together the group. We didn't have the time there, but if you called together the group and sat down and read an appropriate story in that setting, it would be different than reading it in another setting. The readings. Again. All right. Any general comments you'd like to make about the experience? That is, someone commented. Someone commented about the idea about all the things that they could see there, and I said, "Well, yes, that is the challenge for us. The things are right around us. The things are right in front of our faces, and can we see what's there? That's one of the things, one of the challenges with children is to have them notice and think about the things that are there. Let's just see if these get passed out." That raises the whole question of field trips, too, in general. Field trips can be of great value if you put some thought into them on ahead. Now, depending on the kind of trip, you do not want to leech the enjoyment in life out of a field trip by analyzing it to death before you go and why you're there and why you come back. You have to consider the purpose of the trip. Just like when you read a poem, you don't want to consider each letter and so on of the poem. And so there are different purposes of trips, and you need to think about the purpose. Why are we going? What experience do we want to have here? If you're going to specifically do some real math work, why then you just go for that purpose, and you don't really look at the overall picture. You do some adding and subtracting. If you want to study the weather, you have a particular purpose for going on the trip. Anytime you're going to take your children out to a place whether it's a park, a stream, a woods, whatever, why you need to visit that yourself on ahead, unless, as I said yesterday, you want to just have an adventure. But by going there ahead yourself, of course, you can supervise and you can become aware of some of the things I noticed as I walked through there right in the middle of that cemetery. I hadn't seen it the other evening, but there's a pump, an old pitcher pump. And as soon as I saw that, I immediately realized it would not be a problem because of the group that I had with me. But as soon as I saw that, if I had a group of 13-year-old boys here, why, you would have to be aware of that because you could predict that there would be some people over there pumping this thing away to see whether it will pump and shaking it. You need to think about things like that and know. Now, I did see somebody move the handle, and that's okay. But nobody was abusing it. So you go on ahead and you think like your children will think. And you also have to think of group dynamics and say, now, if the group comes and we go here. If one of you went by yourself, it really doesn't matter which way you go. You could have gone the other road. But when you have a group of 50 people going, if you've been out in the other road, you know that you don't have the kind of shoulder to walk on that we did in this road. So you need to think about the movement. How are you going to get there? What's going to happen when you get there? And do the people know what to do at the moment they arrive? And how do you bring this thing to a closure at the end? Field trips can be quite a challenge. And it's easier to stay in the four walls of the room because you don't have to plan something different. But it's those purposeful little trips outside the room, and they don't have to be very far. You know, a real field trip is really in the field. It doesn't have to be going to the potato chip factory, although you can call that a field trip. It doesn't have to be one of these places that's set up to receive school children. You can go to, think of, have your children ever actually seen how a feedlot operates. We had some years ago, on the last day of school, we divided the group into three groups, and this was at the children's suggestion. One of the girls said, I really have no idea what happens inside that freestall barn, how the silo unloader works. You know, she grew up in a farm herself. And so we took them in three groups, and the one group went to my brother's dairy farm, and, you know, this seemed kind of unusual for them to take people they knew out and show them how the feeder worked. But don't, you know, it's the carpenters, it's the shoemaker's children that don't have shoes. And be aware that the children in your own community, even though they live just a quarter mile from the dairy farm, that doesn't mean that they ever saw cows being milked. Yeah. And so don't think of these far off places you can go to a big city to make sure they see the IMAX film and miss the awareness of what's happening in your own community. All right, in the few minutes we have left, I'll call your attention to this paper that's called Grading Difficult Subjects. Another aspect of teaching, well, what's difficult about it? The thing is that you can't really check that there are 5 wrong and 25 right, and therefore the score is whatever, 90%. Things like art and penmanship and so on. Two things to consider are the effort and the academic quality of the work. And there is such a thing. You need to be aware that when you check math, probably if there are 20 problems and the child has one wrong, you probably give him a 95%. And you don't say, well, math comes hard to him, so I guess I'll give him a 97. You probably don't do that. But we are inclined, perhaps, in something like phys ed and penmanship to say, well, he really has difficulty writing. He really can't, he's not as capable as other people, and so we give him, in the academic aspect of it, we'll give him an A anyway. Well, you see, if you clearly point out that in each area of work there is such a thing as a standard of performance, and if you can do it, you can do it. If you can't do it, you can't do it. And it has nothing to do with your value as a person or what you're worth at all. And so if you're going to give a 95% with one wrong in math, also you should, if they cannot do as well in one of these other subjects, don't be afraid to give a lower academic score. And you also do want to consider effort. One thing to be careful about in our schools is that we don't, you know, most people, nobody wants to be average. And be careful that B or even A does not become the average score. You do your children an injustice if, you know, would a child be devastated to get a C? C used to mean average. And if all of your children get A's, and then now and then if you get B's, what you're saying is that our children, we have no average children in our school. Or else, well, whatever you... All I'm saying is think about your grading system. A should mean, especially in these soft subjects that require subjective evaluation, A should mean that there's something outstanding, there's something that really goes, something distinctive about it that is really... really outstanding. And maybe everyone is that way. If that's the case, all right. But you ought to be able to say what it is that makes that an A, and so on down the line. It's very helpful to give in these subjects a separate effort score, or if you're going to combine them in one, at least let the person know that this includes both the academic and the effort. And so if you're having an art class and he really puts himself into it, yes, it may look whatever. It may not look like you want it to look, but he might have really tried. So you need to be aware of both application and the end result. Now, the key thing, though, in grading these subjects is to be sure that you have an objective for the lesson. Be sure that in this particular lesson today, you know, and they know, what item it is that you're particularly focusing on. You do not try to do everything every time. Now, especially when you're just starting. And be able to, for example, in an art class, what is your focus here? If you want them to shade, then that's the primary thing that you're looking at how you shaded. We're not really looking so much at the choice of color or whether you stayed within the lines or whatever, because we want you to focus on the shading. And the child should feel free to focus on that. And in some other areas, he might not do as well in this lesson, but what's your primary... Now, you don't want him to be careless, but you want him to be free to focus on the item that you are emphasizing today. And so in art, you want to... If you don't have a goal for the lesson, why then it's going to be very difficult for you to score it because you don't know what to score. You don't know what to evaluate because you have not given a standard. And so you have to know what that particular one is. If, for example, you want them to draw isometrically or in perspective, why there's some particular things to look for. Do the lines go towards the vanishing point that are supposed to? Are the vertical lines vertical? Or if you're teaching children to draw a house, is the chimney vertical or is the chimney sticking out of the roof at an angle? By the way, we do have a stovepipe in our community that sticks out of the roof the way children draw chimneys out of roofs. It's fascinating to go past and see that stovepipe coming out. It's perpendicular to the roof slope and it looks very unusual. Anyway, with penmanship is really easier than art to grade because you have particular specific items to look at. You have it, and you can focus on one at a time. But as the children get older, you have about six things to look at. Are the letters on the line or are they hanging up in the air? Are the letters of uniform size or some big and some little? Do they get smaller as the line goes across or are they uniform in size? Is there a slant there? And are they formed properly? And so if you're going to give us, and if you give a score of a C or whatever, if it's not a good score, you ought to be able to just quickly circle a couple things so the child can glance at that paper and he knows immediately that the thing inside that circle is the problem. And if you may have to use a word to call attention to explain what the circle is, but depending on how well the child knows you and you know the child, if there's a circle between the letter and the line, why he knows that the problem is that the letter's not on the line, or if the letters are slanted backwards and you just draw a line at the proper slant, a couple lines like that, he gets the idea, we need to work on the slant. And so you have specific things to look at. Music is another one that I say grade on singing ability observed. Now that is not how well maybe the child could sing at home, but how well he does in fact sing in music class. And again, he may not be a good singer and maybe cannot hold a match a tone. Well, that does call for a lower score in that element. That's not because that child is of any less value, but if he cannot do his sums in addition, that reflects in the score. And if he cannot produce a sound, that also reflects in the score. And so you have to be, there's a certain amount of objectivity about this. And we know that. And if you give a child an A and he can't hold a tune, why, you're not being honest, and he knows that. And so be understanding, but fair. And then you also consider music is one of those areas that it exposes the real you more than any other subject, perhaps, because it involves putting your feelings and your emotions into it. It's difficult to sing about something that you do not feel about, if you do not care, and so that's a big part of it. And children, by the way, in music, should have opportunity to sing some songs in addition to gospel songs and hymns. There are many, many, many other things to sing about, and there ought to be some more songs written about the birds and the bees and the trees and the work and so on. And that other kinds of songs in addition to the hymns are, they may be more interested in singing. With composition, when you're writing, this is an important one. Be sure that you have, again, they need to know what they're going to be graded on, and you know what you're going to grade them on. You're going to take them outside and sit down and say, all right, let's try writing some poetry. So you read them a couple poems. Now you try it. Let's write a poem about the clouds or about the sky. What you're going to be evaluating is what you see when you read that. They're supposed to be free from the constraints of having to worry too closely about rhyme and rhythm and meter and all that. They want to think and feel poetically. And so you might tell them, try to use some words in some unusual ways. And that's what I'm going to be looking at. Maybe take a routine word, but use it in an unusual way. Or put some feeling in it. Put some feeling in that. Somehow express your feeling. And so when you read that, that's what you look for. Or if you are developing paragraphs and you're talking about paragraph structure, and you want them to have a topic sentence, or you want them to have transition or whatever, isolate the item that you're focusing on in today's lesson. And that's the major thing that you score. Now, if in fact you're going to have them then revise it and recopy it and make a final copy to perhaps put in the school newsletter or to hang on the wall, and just to make a final copy, then is when you want to start talking about the other things and say, now, when you're finished revising and then you proofread, now we want to look at a number of different things. You have to think about punctuation, and you have to think about spelling, and you have to think about these other things in the final product. But that's a separate activity from producing it in the first place. And so they need to know when you're going to grade this piece, does spelling count on this piece? Well, you don't want them to just pay no attention to that. But that's not your primary thing if you're trying to focus on learning something new. How do you grade memory work? One of the ways to objectify that a bit is to consider some separate elements. How long did it take you to say the whole piece in terms of minutes? It makes a difference. If you recite 1 Corinthians 13, one person does it in 4 minutes or 2 minutes, and the other person does it in 15 minutes, that tells you something about it. You know something about how well he knows the piece. And the number of errors, how many times he had to repeat, smoothness, where a scale of 5 would be just moving right on without any hesitation, and one would be long pauses and backing up and starting over. And so you consider some of these different elements, and then again, it's somewhat soft, but it gives you some separate things to consider. And you can point to some particular items. This is why you have a B instead of an A in this area. You needed two prompts or whatever. It's good in memory also to have a minimum allowable score. In Bible memory, we don't allow anything less than a C-. We do, by the way. And that's another question, whether you even want to grade Bible memory. People come out different places on that. You can work that out on your own. But some children in memory work will say, well, I really don't want to do this. I'm satisfied to take a zero. So just give me a zero. No, that's not an option. That's not an option. You will learn this at least well enough to get a C. So sometimes you have to have a minimum there. And again, with oral reading, you have some particular things, specific things you can look at. Do they read slowly enough? Did you notice what I said? I've challenged students already. I said I challenge you to read too slowly. And I have some that took me up on the challenge, and some almost did it. But when it comes to reciting poetry, it's a rare person who reads slowly enough to put the proper emphasis in oral reading. All right, and so the other things, you can emphasize these one at a time. You can say, come up front, read to the class. Today we're going to particularly be considering eye contact. One at a time you can do these items. And then as they get more experience, you can consider them all, but they know that there are specific things that you are considering. You're not just saying, oh, that was a great job, so you get a B. No, you can make a little check sheet, and when the child's finished, you can go down through there and give them from a 1 to a 5 or 1 to 10. And another thing that will really mean something is if you make slips for everybody in the group, and when he's finished reading, he gets all these slips from all his classmates, and his classmates all have marked on their slips that you did not read loudly enough. You know, volume, you get a 1 for volume. And he gets all this testimony from the whole class. But tell you, they might not believe what you say, but they'll believe what their classmates say when the classmates say, we couldn't understand you. And with projects, of course, there are separate things to look at, deadlines met, and so on. Our morning has passed. A couple announcements before we ask the blessing for lunch. The bookstore I referred to this morning, that's at the end of the walkway, right out here to the east, will be open today till about 8 o'clock this evening. It will not be open tomorrow. If there's a big groundswell of interest tomorrow and you ask Steve Brubaker, he might open it up for a while, but if you want to see it today. All right, and this afternoon, for the afternoon events, go right to where you're going. Don't all gather together. I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding yesterday whether we should all gather here or go to our places. So go right to the place where your workshop is being held this afternoon. Any other questions? If any of you were not here yesterday or the day before and want a handout, I have copies of, I think, all of them here. Just come up and help yourself. All right, let's stand together to ask the blessing.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.